Harris, and you are about to embark on the next Pioneer Knowledge Services Because You Need to Know, a digital resource for you to listen to folks share their experience and knowledge around the field of knowledge management and nonprofit work. If your company or organization would like to help us continue this mission and sponsor one of our shows, email BYNTK at pioneer-ks.org.
Hi, and welcome. My name is Clark Quinn. I live here in beautiful Walnut Creek, California, which is San Francisco Bay Area, if you don't know. I currently work for clients through Quinnovation as a consultant on learning experience strategy design. Also currently work for the Learning and Development Accelerator, which is a evidence-based L&D focused society in the capacity of co-director. I just wrote my latest book, Make It Meaningful, Taking Learning Design from Instructional to Transformational. And my most fantastic work experience was teaching at the University of New South Wales. And I ended up developing a game for kids who need to learn to live on their own. They're in forms of care and they need to learn to survive on the street.
What is an interesting thing around where you live?
It's Mount Diablo. Is a big mountain that sort of dominates the local area. From that, you get as good of views as you'll get anywhere in the Bay Area until you get all the way out to the Sierra Nevadas.
As organizations try to become learning organizations, and I know that's a sweet spot for you, the theory of learning, or at least the action of learning, is a key ingredient for you. How do organizations function well or unwell in your perspective?
The thing I've seen most with organizations is they're not well aligned with what we know about how we think, work, and learn. Annual reviews or semi-annual reviews, we have a lot of evidence these aren't useful, and yet they persist. And I've begun to believe that this is because we have a mistaken view of our organizations have a mistaken view of how people actually operate. They think we're these formal, logical, reasoning beings. Mm-hmm. And there's considerable evidence in cognitive science and marketing, freakonomics, types of behavioral economics, that shows that we're not. We have systematic flaws. And yet we do things like present training that's a bunch of information dump and think that'll change people's behavior. We think how people represent at work doesn't matter. We should put on a mask and just pretend to be professional. And if we're having personal troubles, it doesn't matter. Whole bunch of different ways. What organizations do just interferes with the ability to get the best out of people. And that to me is a problem.
Is it just the leftover mentality of a systems assembly line, industrial revolution mindset of how work gets done that has to be uprooted and something else planted?
Yes, and so I think that Taylorism, that scientific management that says, oh, people are cogs in a machine, is part of it. But it's also in the 50s, we had the cognitive revolution where we went from behaviorism to a view that said we can know what goes on in the brain. But those were still based on sort of computer models that said, oh, well, if we give people good rules and they'll execute against them reliably. And that turns out not to be the case. Our architecture is incredibly powerful, allowing us to do amazing things like be able to have this conversation across the country. Yeah. And yet there are also systematic flaws that we have to work around. Also great potential we can take advantage of, and we're just not. So it is that legacy. And I think we need to upgrade our understanding of people and then make our policies and practices align with that better.
Is it your view that most humans on the planet get their learning from informal versus formal?
Yes, and I like what David Geary did with his evolutionarily primary and secondary learning. He talked about the things that we are organized to learn well. Hmm. You know, we learn pick up language relatively easily, certainly a primary language, and we learn how to read people to some extent. But then there are things we've created, like mathematics and business itself and economics, that our brains aren't wired to learn. And formal learning accelerates that. We can learn it in apprenticeship, but we also are doing things in our formal education that aren't aligned with how our brains learn. We tend to do this information dump, test the knowledge at the end, and we're done, which doesn't match the way our brains work. We need little bits of increment over time. We need repeated practice and actually using the information the ways we'll use it afterwards. Yes, we do learn informally for the things we can. We can learn more effectively for the things that are challenging for us to learn, and we're not doing a good job of that. I have a sort of cheeky statement. L&D isn't doing near what it could and should, and what it is doing, it's doing badly. Other than that, it's fine.
tell me what you're saying L&D is.
Learning and development tends to be the body that runs training, and after sort of 9-1-1 and also the pandemic, tends to be responsible also for e-learning. They're responsible for formal learning in organizations. Whoever is that, we tend to label them as L&D.
Is that a sign of organizational maturity if they have an L&D arm or training official capacity in their org structure?
No. That's
interesting.
That's like cost of entry. I believe that, you know, in this increasingly dynamic environment, optimal execution is only the cost of entry, and continual innovation will be the only sustainable differentiator. Having an L&D department is a step in the right direction, but most of them are still mired in old models of how we learn.
Yeah.
They're still doing bullet point presentations and training where they throw stuff around because they're only evaluating themselves on whether people like or think the learning is valuable, which turns out not to be a very good indicator. The correlation between what people think learning event is in terms of its effectiveness and what it actually is about 0.09, which is zero with a rounding error. It's just not. L&D, you want to recognize that a learning organization, but in many cases, people are arguing, let's not have L&D. First of all, I think we should call it performance and development because we should be also looking at performance support, because there's times where it doesn't make sense to try and put it in the head. We should put the solution in the world, provide support for people to perform in the moment rather than trying to put it in the head. But then also we can and should be facilitating that informal learning you referred to earlier. Mm-hmm. There are ways that that works well and not well.
Yeah.
It would help if we actually facilitated the most effective means of that as part of the responsibility of L&D or performance and development.
Well, how much of that is engrossed in how the culture operates or how the culture shows up to begin with? I bring that up because in a organization that has a high trust level, then learning can be easier to transfer, I would think. In my review of different organizations in your conversation that I'm thinking about, to me, it's like the trust level is the indicator that shows how well people are willing to engage in anything in the organization. How does L&D come in to, I understand having training objectives and learning objectives and all these things that have to be done in an organization that are necessary, but it still doesn't address how do you motivate? How do you motivate somebody to learn or to engage?
A couple things. You know, there are several levels. There's sort of the skills and tactical levels of knowing how to be an effective self-learner and how to learn well together. And above that, and you're absolutely right, you know, the culture, whether it's a learning organization or not, matters. Learning has to be valued and contributing has to be valued. So trust is important. I like what Amy Edmondson talks about, safety as well. If you have what I call the Miranda organization, where anything you say can and will be held against you, nobody's going to contribute, right? It's not safe. And the leadership has to walk the walk. I argue that L&D and the learning organization itself needs to master these practices of being a learning organization internally before they can credibly take it outside. But so it's knowing the practices, it's sharing the practices, working with people, motivating learning. People have to understand that they no longer can stay static. Things are happening. And people do self-help, but not necessarily effectively. And if we focused on trying to help people be better learning, many years ago, I worked with the late Jay Cross, who wrote the fabulous book, Informal Learning. We were worried about helping organizations help their people be more effective learners. That may be the best investment you can make, because then people can continue to improve themselves. And yet we tend to ignore that meta learning or learning to learn.
Wasn't there like an old something about teach a man to fish kind of concept? There is something about, I think, there must be an inhibitor in most people's brain pans that are like, oh, I don't want to learn today. You got to kind of, a spoonful of sugar, right, helps the medicine go down. So if you've got, and I think, and then that's what brings me back to what I wanted to get to, which is instructional design. My experience with instructional design was mind-blowing to me because I was always in military training. So let's define that. What's the difference between training and learning?
Learning is something that happens, but training is specifically focused learning. It's designed to accelerate your ability to acquire specific. You talked about instructional objectives or learning objectives. Yes, learning, people may choose whatever, but when we want specific learning to occur to a certain level, we design learning experiences, which you can call training, you can call learning experience design, whatever you want. But that's to achieve specific outcomes that we know are important in your military experience. That's where people's lives depend on it. We tend to get the best investments in it. It's not perfect, but it tends to be better. And, you know, aviation industry and medicine are places where people's lives are on the line. They do it better than most organizations.
So there's a higher fidelity of the why in those circumstances. There is more at stake, is what you're saying. Let's go back and let's, for the listener's sake, explain what instructional design is all about, please.
To me, instructional design is about taking what we know from how our brains learn and using that to design experiences that will lead to transformation in your abilities. In other words, the process says, okay, we need you to acquire this skill. We will, a good objective states, you will be able to do this under these conditions to this level of performance. And then you align a series of activities to achieve that. You do the analysis to make sure you have the right objectives. And then you say, what do they start at? And then you say, what series of activities, what series of practice and information will lead them to the ability to acquire that ability? And that whole process is instructional design. The one thing that traditional instructional design has not incorporated sufficiently is the emotional side of the equation, is making sure that people are motivated, making sure that people aren't being overwhelmed by anxiety, and deliberately building their confidence. So at the end of the learning experience, not only are they capable of doing it, but they're willing to give it a go after the learning experience when it matters. You may have heard, your audience may have heard the new phrase learning experience design as opposed to instructional design. That to me is what I want to be the differentiator between them, is that incorporation of the emotional side of the equation as well as the cognitive.
From my view of what I saw of instructional designers, they were more student focused than they were. The old style that they replaced, and this was in the military, was the old style of military training. And the commander at that point said, you know what, we need to change how we teach. Because the model was old soldiers came back and taught new soldiers. So you had subject matter experts or experienced soldiers that were behind the podium saying, thou shalt not. And it was a huge cultural battle. But what I saw was when the dust settles, the instructional designer had no emotional tie to any of the content, none whatsoever, actually no even frame of reference, you know. But they could come super objectively and look at the content and be able to pull out the nuggets that were useful instead of hearing, well, then we ran up this hill. You know, all the old stories that people like to tell versus the actual content, and make it more absorbable. And that's my term. It made it more cohesive to the learner. And maybe that was a motivational thing too, versus a lecture format. It was a lot of work, and I didn't really realize how much consumption of data and information it took to get to a teachable moment, a piece of learning that could be pushed out or taught from. It's really a synthesis. It's really a very mind-blowing way to synthesize something so the user can consume it.
And there's two points that I want to make related to what you're saying. The first one is, we now have evidence that when somebody isn't expert at a task, like your experienced military men who come up and speak at the, or women at the, speak at the podium, they don't actually, they no longer have access to what they do. Because the way our brain works is we compile that information away. They have access to what they know, and they tell stories and dump knowledge. You know, there is a role for that when you have examples of stuff going into context, but you need to know a lot more. And the other problem is that the difference between well-produced learning experiences, in other words, where some designer has taken information and made it look amazing and tests knowledge, and actually effective learning, where actually what they're doing is not just retrieving the knowledge, but applying it in the way they'll have to apply it after learning experience. The nuances are subtle, and too often well-produced stuff doesn't look much different than well-produced and well-designed stuff, but it makes a huge difference in the outcome. And yet you have to know those nuances to be able to know when you're being sold a bill of goods and you're being sold a real solution.
So is there any organization out there that shouldn't be listening to your advice? Is there a certain industry that's like, eh, you don't need this stuff?
A lot of the well, it's endemic because the purchasers, too much of L&D isn't aware of what it takes. And the people in the ground level are fighting against people who are going, well, I've seen that you can take content and put it into an authoring tool and produce an experience in 2 weeks. Why should I expect any more than that? Yeah, but that's not going to lead to any outcome, but the industry doesn't measure. And the vendors go along with this. It's easy for them to take content and produce it. So you've got both sides of the equation not aware of what it takes. Mm-hmm. I argue that L&D needs to start measuring impact, not just efficiency. Right now they measure how much does it cost to put a butt in a seat for an hour? And instead of measuring, is that butt in that seat for an hour actually impacting our business? And we need to break that.
Walk me through what exactly is broken in the alignment of an organization that needs to be fixed.
A couple things. Learning and development can't remain in a little bubble. It's very comfortable to take orders for courses and produce what to ask for and believe. It's really a faith-based industry, and I use that term loosely. Don't hold me too strictly to it. If we build it, it is good. And that can't happen. They need to be more proactive and go, you want a course on this? What is the problem you're trying to fix? And let's make sure we're solving that. And how will you know it's fixed? So that's what you start with. And I argue that if you start instituting appropriate measurement, that will be a catalyst to force people to go, oh, what I'm doing isn't working. And they're scared of that right now, which is a problem. And we need to make it safe for them to admit that and start doing better. And then I argue they need to go beyond that and start looking at performance support. Job aids, which I'm sure you had in the military. You had checklists and
lots of job aids. Oh boy. Yeah.
Because they make sense. Yep. People talk about, oh, microlearning is that YouTube video you downloaded that helped you fix your dryer. I did that. I absolutely have a dryer that's now worked ever since. I didn't learn a thing. I have no idea what I did. And that is perfectly okay. It's brilliant. Why do I have to learn anything? I got the job done. But we have to move out of that. We have to put it in the head, and our job is training. We have to think our job is performance, and we need to measure that. And then we need to start also making learning organizations inside L&D. And when we understand it and have it working, we then need to take that out as well. Because, and I'll argue that for both practical and principled reasons. The principled reason is because when you're doing innovation, troubleshooting, design, all these innovative things, you don't know the answer when you start. So by definition, they're learning. Facilitating, there isn't anybody with the right answer. You would bring them in and they'd tell you and you just do it, but you have to figure it out. But it still requires some of what people who know understand learning can facilitate. And the pragmatic reason for L&D and, you know, even knowledge management is to go in, and because that continual innovation is going to be the differentiator for organizations, becoming the facilitator of that moves you from being the periphery, oh, well, you know, times are tough, we perform well enough, let's get rid of the thing that helps us perform optimally. Oh, but we need to continue to innovate to be able to adapt in this new environment. Suddenly you're moved from the periphery to the center of value to the organization. And I think that's really important, strategic, and a role that is apt for anybody who does understand how learning works. And one of the major barriers, back to your question, one of the major barriers is that too many folks in L&D don't really understand how we learn, how our brains work.
That sounds like something that is a necessary function in order to be, as you're saying, performance-based or outcome-based. I just say it's a mimicking tool, right? You want to mimic how the solution got there in your story of the dryer, right? And I think that that just popped something in my brain because that is something I don't think a lot of folks see value in. Do I have to learn that? No, just show me what I need to do to get the job done. And if more organizations would take 20% of their brain power and say, what can we, you know, going back to the training aids, what can we do that just helps people out of a pickle, gives them a solution set that they don't have to understand anything, just follow A through Z and boom, done, move on. I wouldn't classify that as innovation. You know, you keep talking innovation, but being able to increase the performance level of doing and reducing the friction of not knowing, searching, trying to find an answer, just sit and spin is a huge game changer. But we don't even talk about that piece. And once you said the mimicking, well, that's what I heard was mimicking. And it's, I've done the same thing. I had a John Deere tractor. I didn't know how to put the snowblower on. I whip out this manual and I'm like, oh my good God, I'm not reading this. You know, because it's like page after, oh, little stick figure. And I'm like, God, no. So I did the same thing. Just search. And the coolest thing was this guy just set up a camera. Did not say one word. There was no graphics. It was just the camera and this dude putting these parts together. And that's all it was. There was no content development. It was just, here, watch this. And so I would watch a little bit, pause it, go do that, come back, play a little more. That's how easy this can all be.
Absolutely. It's really funny. I had a consulting engagement with a firm a number of years ago where they were coming up with a strategy for innovation and learning experience and customer experience. And I sat in on their week-long workshop, but they'd broken up so that training had its own week. The rest of the website of support had its other week. What ended up being my whole job that week was to keep them from devolving to going, okay, we're going to put that in a course and go, wait. And the funny thing, my direct client that I was working with told me that on their website, the most successful content, the content that was hit the most, was a bunch of how-to videos. But yet they thought they had to develop training. It was like, no.
And I think there's an automatic feature in L&D and training facilities and things that they've got one hammer. And that's to build courses, right? That's all we got. So everything's going to be a course. And it doesn't have to be. How do you decipher when it should be or when it shouldn't be a course?
There's several situations that are clues. One is if it doesn't happen very frequently, if it's not happening very often, trying to put it in the head is highly unlikely because it's going to be gone by the time it gets there, unless you spend a lot of effort. In the aviation industry, pilots train so much every year for things they hope never happens. But when it does, it's really important. So if it's infrequent, trying to put it in the head. And if it's something that is contrary to our cognitive architecture, so there's a whole bunch of sort of gaps. We have limited working memory. If it requires more working memory, put it in the world. Arbitrary information. We have real trouble remembering arbitrary information. Give a lookup table. If you do something repeatedly through the day, if you look at Atul Gawande's book, The Checklist Manifesto, he talks about people who performed several surgeries in the day, late in the day, they would think they'd perform this step because they'd performed it two previous surgeries.
Yeah.
And all he did was create a checklist to get by it. So there's a number of ways in which our brains struggle to do things, and providing support that work around that. We have done it. We can't do large calculations in our head. That's why we created calculators. First abacuses and then calculators. We create diagrams to understand stuff because we can't remember all the relationships. The list goes on of the tools we've developed. And if you are finding that the gap is based upon one of these limitations of our cognitive architecture, training probably can't get rid of it. That's a good time to use a tool.
There's an evaluation of complexity and time. How'd you
frequency.
Say it? Frequency.
Frequency.
Yes, frequency.
Yeah.
complexity and frequency are kind of your indicators to what we develop and what we don't need to. I want to go back to the graphic aids, because now that you got my brain going, I probably got an old box of training aids that, you know, I still have. And it's, why is it only the military seems to develop? I'm not saying all civilian organizations don't, but that's the only place I've ever seen them in prevalence. Mm-hmm. Is that something you think is just an easy way, low cost kind of way to aid the organization if they had more of that? Or is it just too low tech and not very sexy? Is that
I think it's a mindset about the recognizing that trying to put everything in the head is back to that old, we're formal logical reasoning beings. If we put it in the head, we're done. And recognizing more accurately how we think. So the Coast Guard is only quasi-military in that sense, and yet they really got performance support, and they invested in it heavily. They brought in experts, and they focused on how much can we put in the world and reduce what has to be in the head. You talk about the military. I'll mention also aviation and medicine as places where performance matters, and that's where they tend to put a greater recognition of what works and an emphasis on measurement, because it costs them a lot of money if they screw up. You know, lives are expensive in lots of ways. Absolutely. A greater awareness of how we could be more effective without having to invest in heavy training is needed. And when people get it, it does lead to much better outcomes for them. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Sort of to the topic of knowledge management, you go around, look, and people may have created these tools. And instead of creating them anew, we should be curating them. One of the mantras that more progressive thinkers in L&D talk about is curate before create, because there may be a better solution out there. Why do you have to do the not invented here syndrome? Oh, well, I have to create. Well, no, go find somebody's. If it needs fine tuning a little bit, add your magic, a visual design, a graphic design, instructional design, cognitive design. But don't assume you have to create it a priori. Go see what people are doing. Interface design, I was steeped in that early in my career. The grad school experience of the lab was doing interface design for designing for how people think. My twist was design for how people learn. Mm. But they were way ahead of going and looking at people's situation and recognizing that they had a problem with the interface, but they'd solved it with a post-it that they referred to. And so they didn't know that they had a problem with the interface because they'd already solved it. The interface designer would take that, mm-hmm. take a photo of that post-it and go figure out what that meant for the design of the interface. And we're so far behind in that from the L&D and instructional design perspective.
On the medical front, I was at a KM conference, but I talked to an organization's chief technology officer, and I asked them about knowledge management and user interface, user design, and all that. I said, how does the people in knowledge management show up in your organization? How do you facet that in? He said, well, we don't care about the people. We build the systems and they use it. He was just serious as heck. He was just like, oh, yeah, we don't worry about them. They use what we tell them to use, you know, that sort of thing. And it's like, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, is that a Stone Age kind of mentality for, you know, organizational structures?
Well, and Don Norman up here on my shelf, he was my PhD advisor. He's written a number of books. One of them was called The Invisible Computer. And he talked about how, you know, marketing comes with the requirements and engineering develops it. And then they put in user interface at the end to make it acceptable. Yeah. What they end up doing is patching all the bad design decisions that missed. And he argued for bringing user perspective up front so that you didn't make those mistakes you have to patch over. And you and I both have experienced, and everybody listening has experienced software that's designed in that way that says, just put an interface, fix everything that doesn't work.
Make it a different font. They'll love it. Well, why don't you give me your definition of what knowledge management is?
My colleague Harold Jarkey was one of the Jay Cross, who wrote the book Informal Learning, went around afterwards talking about it and realized I'm arguing for doing things together and I'm doing this alone. So he brought a few of us together, and that included Charles Jennings, Jane Hart, and Harold Jarkey. And Harold came from sort of knowledge management. And he argued that it was brittle. And he argues the modern version of knowledge management is getting people to share knowledge and unpacking tacit knowledge and not trying to formalize it, but making it available to people. And that's my perspective on it very much. And it's interesting. I was reading about, to prep for this, I looked up a little bit about knowledge management to refresh my memory. And one of these was mentioning trends in 2023 for knowledge management. The first one was knowledge is social. So, and the interesting one, yeah, I can't remember if it was in that article or another one, but they said the natural home for knowledge management is with L&D. It's about learning. And there's a connection. So I don't feel so bad having been talking about learning so much in your knowledge management podcast.
There is a lot of similarities, and they are in hand in hand. I always felt that, in similar to what you were just saying, I always felt it would be best housed alongside HR. So you're working with requirements and job descriptions and expectations and behaviors and all those sorts of things to help the organization build a better widget of why are these people here? And if they're not built and or expected to share knowledge, then you're shooting yourself in the foot. You might as well say they're not here to learn either. They're just here to build stuff. That's it. Very undynamic to think that the human ability will be happy in the cog, square hole, round hole kind of mentality anymore. It may have been great 150 years ago when you got your choices of pitchforks or what have you. And it's like, no, that horse has left the barn. People have a higher expectation and a want and desire and of how they show up at work.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, in some ways it made sense. Not everybody had access to higher education in the old days. And so a few people had to do the thinking for the rest. And we didn't have as fantastic technology solutions as we have now. We didn't have robots and things. But that's changed. And you're absolutely right. And I think these days, it's the difference between organizations to say, oh, we have these problematic people, we have to keep them under control, versus the organizations go, we've got the fabulous people who aren't performing well because we haven't given them the organized what we're doing to free them up to be their best. And I think that shift in mentality is sort of fundamental to being able to really create what they call the learning organization, which is an organization where information is available and shared, and together we learn better. We are smarter than me.
Tell me what the superstructure of an organization should look like. Now, we all know hierarchical. We all know command structure and all that sort of thing. So, and holacracy, if anyone knows holacracy, holacracy is a very interesting biological looking org structure, and it's all around outputs. So how do you build the best solution for building an organization?
At one level, that's beyond my pay grade type of answer. but it is something
I... Let's couch it like this. You've got a magic wish. What would be your best design concept?
I've looked at a couple things. I think it was Cotter, I'm not sure, but was arguing for a parallel structure. You have the hierarchy to execute the things you know you need to do, but then you pulled it out and you created these teams that were in parallel, were pulled from the different hierarchy, but they were assigned to solve problems and innovate. So he had sort of had a parallel structure, whereas other thinkers, and this includes people like Dave Gray with his book, The Connected Company, I think Stan McChrystal with his Team of Teams, Amy Edmondson, when she's talking about teaming, they talked about a more podular structure where you started having small groups responsible and you had groups that managed groups, but it was all a series of groups and periphery. Oh, Dan Ponterfecht, I think, talked a little bit about that as well in his book, which I have on my shelf, and title isn't coming to spring into mind. But these structures are more natural. It sounds a bit like your holacracy, where you have groups that are responsible for each other and responsible for tasks, and they have interchanges between each other, and there's a semi-permeable membrane at the periphery of the organization where exchanges are going in and out there as well. And I think that more naturally fits people. It's just, how do you make sure it's doing the things it needs to do? And I think that can be accomplished, but it really takes a fundamental rethink of the culture, the processes, the policies, the infrastructure. A lot of it has to be working well together for that to be successful.
Well, as organizations have adopted and adapted to the technological changes in the world, does the systematic approach or the business process idea get more codified or less? Everything that you've kind of pointed towards is a social construct, learning social construct. Organizations should be more of a social construct. How do we, I guess, combat? Because when you were saying that, I was like, well, we're reliant. I see so many organizations that do operations via email. you know, it's very much a broken system when we're still reliant upon these mundane tools as an operating capacity of an organization versus the social structure. I don't know how many times I've told somebody, why are you sending an email? That's like a phone call. You should be calling them. You know what I mean? There's like different expectations for different modes of communication, but is it too easy to hide behind the email?
Yes, and I'm guilty of it, by the way. I have phone anxiety. So you remember the old computer anxiety? I have phone anxiety. But I don't think we really have good tools yet. For instance, our collaboration tools, they tend to be fixed into it. Well, it's a text document or it's an image or it's a spreadsheet. Instead of recognizing many, many years ago on an early Mac program was Trapeze, which allowed you to have mix images and text, blocks of numbers that interoperated. And I'm thinking, that's what we need. But when I was an undergraduate, I did what was effectively an honors project with some faculty members. We took a classroom and we used email to conduct classroom discussion. Half the class was split, half was in class and half did it by email. And then they were supposed to switch. It didn't happen for complicated reasons. But one of the things we found was that some people who had been really active in classroom weren't active in email and vice versa. Different people have different channels. And I think it's important to have a variety of different channels for different messages. You don't just have email and phone. You tend to have Slack or Teams or something where you can send messages as well. And I think what we see happening in organizations is we'll get beliefs about how you should behave. And this business unit does it differently. And that may be okay. We may need to tolerate that. But at the end of the day, make sure the messages are getting out. We're talking about how important it is to work out loud, for instance. Mm-hmm. What should you be sharing and how frequently? Well, we'll learn a little bit about it, but really it needs to be, this is new. Here's what my goal is. Here's my plan. Here's my current status. Okay. That in itself will give people ability to align, to understand, be able to provide useful suggestions to improve, but you also have the culture where you don't attack people for what they share. You look to improve if you can, or you learn from it. I don't think we're not quite at the place with the right tools to facilitate this. We don't have, you know, we're still learning the policies and procedures.
Even if you went back and put the mirror of instructional design up to what you're just talking about and said, look at this. To me, it's still what's missing is, like you said, learners have different modalities they naturally fall for. So therefore, the organization should be looking at making products, artifacts, that are built to share knowledge and or train or learn or whatever the outcome is. But they should be doing it in two or three different ways, right?
Yes.
If you're going to be learner-centric, you need to come up with different ways of transfer of knowledge.
Yes, and you do need to have different channels for different types of messages. You also need to recognize my preferences and learners' preferences aren't a good indication for how they best learn. What they state and what they do doesn't even correlate. So you want to find some practices. And I really like Garvin Edmondson and Gino wrote a paper for Harvard Business Review talking about evaluating dimensions of a learning organization. And they created a representation that I use in presentations a lot that talks about, you know, you need this environment. It needs to be open-minded and valuing diversity, not just tolerating, but valuing diversity and having time for reflection, psychological safety. But then they go, you also need these practices. You need experimentation. You need smart experimentation where you have done it so that you learn what's learned from that. You either avoid that or you bake it into your practices and continue to evolve. And finally, they talked about leadership, and I sort of extended what they said. Not just they have to support it, but they have to walk the walk. If your boss says share mistakes and your boss doesn't share mistakes, are you really going to believe that that's an acceptable behavior? Mm-hmm. So they based that on evaluation of organizations, and it was some very specific recommendations that I think are part of the direction we need to go. But it included continue experiment and improve that.
Could you tell the listeners the name of your book and where to get it?
Which one?
All right. All of them.
Right. The one most relevant for this conversation was a book I was really pleased to write called Revolutionize Learning and Development. performance and innovation strategy for the 21st century. I argue a lot of L&D and business practices are still from the previous century, and we need to move it. So revolutionize learning development. I've got a book out on myths and learning organizations subsequent to that. I've got one on learning science for instructional designers. Particularly the chapter two is really the core of the cognitive processing loop that I think everybody who designs for people really needs to understand. My most recent one is Action Make It Meaningful, is about that emotional side of learning experience. It's the complement to the learning science, but together they sort of create a whole basis for learning experience design. But those are probably the ones that are most relevant to what your audience's interests in.
So what's on the future? What's on your to-do list for the next 5 years?
besides, you know, continuing with the activities I'm part of, I think the society is something I'll continue. I'm really enjoying the experience with Upside Learning because it's given me a chance to practice what I preach, and they're really committed to making, really applying learning science to what they're doing. So that's good. The one thing I'm thinking is the most important thing I can give, I refer to that second chapter in a learning science book. I'm increasingly thinking everybody in our industry needs to understand that basic human information processing loop. And I'm beginning to look for ways to get that available. I have an asynchronous workshop on it, and I could do it with a webinar, but it really works best live. I do it experientially. So I do some actual psych experiments to help make it visceral and then explain what that tells us about it. And I'm just trying to find a way to get that to everybody, because many people talk about learning science, including my, you know, PhD advisor and things, and talk about designing the cognitive loop. But I think that one way of thinking about it, my now 40 years of experience, suggests that that's the most useful thing, and I'm working on getting that out there.
L&D and knowledge management need to cohese and become a chief cognitive officer for an organization. Should cognition be brought in as a principle, right? I mean, and that's the superstructure of everything we've been talking about. Knowledge management, learning, development should be all in cognition. So is there a way you can test an organization's cognition proficiency?
There have been a couple stabs. I think yes, by the way. I think really human resources, the human part of it is really our brain. Be clear, cognitive science actually breaks it down to three parts: our cognitive, our affective, and our conative. And our cognitive is, you know, how we think. Our affective is who we are as people. And our conative is our intent to contribute, our intents to participate, our intents to learn. And we need to address all of those. But really, that's what makes us human at work these days. It's not so much our physical capacity in many ways. Yes, I think that's necessary. I think that organizing around supporting people performing at their best makes sense. The first part of your question was, should there be a chief cognitive officer? And that was the second part of the question. And it's,
should we just bring together L&D, KM, HR, and make kind of a hub there about the organization as an organism around those elements of cognition?
I do think so. How do we organize our technology, our practices and policies, our resources, you know, information resources to support people being able to do the best at what they're doing? I absolutely think that's a direction we can and should go.
One of the conflict points I'd seen 15 years ago is that in the organization I was in, they had the chief technology officer sitting at the same tip of the chief knowledge officer. And that's the problem. Once you build fiefdoms, then they all have their lines of resources and all their stuff and all their separate piles of... I could see where there was a little back and forth. It was a new structure. Granted, that was a new structure. When you've got a chief knowledge officer that's looking at the technology providing the pathway for everything that we're doing versus a CTO, which says they're in charge of all the hardware, software, and you'll do what I say. And that was my perspective. There seems to be, now if you had a chief cognition officer that was like, hey, you guys will play and play nicely. I don't know. I know organizations are struggling to try to figure out what's the best way forward. And I think a lot of org structures have the same problem with trying to figure out how are we going to strategize our digital setup here for even be relevant in 10 years. There's just a lot of things to think about running an organization. And this is just one of many.
Absolutely. And that tension in some ways is productive, because I always tell instructional designers, you get so frustrated at IT. They want, you know, you think of them as the preventer of services, right? Then I ask them, do you get upset when the network goes down? And they go, yeah. Understand that they need to do this in a way that's secure and reliable and uptime. And you want what? So work with them and understand. And yet a good IT department knows they have to continue to advance. And one story was told to us many years ago, a company that no longer exists, unfortunately, but they had that tension between the two silos. And they did something very interesting. They made one small change. They made each of their bonuses partly dependent on the success of the other organization. Mm. Just the head of those two units. But their bonuses were dependent on the success of the other one. Suddenly they were incented to get along.
Very, very chummy after that. Yes, yes. Maybe we should talk more. Yes, maybe. Oh, that's funny. People. You know, they're a funny animal.
We are.
Thank you, Clark. It's been a great investigation into a very interesting topic, one that I find very potent for the future.
Well, thank you. It was indeed a great chance to explore some of these issues and the tensions they face. So I appreciate the opportunity.
If your company or organization would like to help us continue this mission and sponsor one of our shows, email bynt@pioneer-ks.org. You have just finished our latest Because You Need to Know, a public service of Pioneer Knowledge Services. Please join us on LinkedIn and find us at pioneer-ks.org.